This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with civil rights lawyer Roger Wareham about the case of the Central Park Five. On April 19th, 1989, a group of five black and Latino teenagers were arrested and convicted for the brutal rape of a white female jogger in Central Park in New York City. A New York court overturned the convictions of the five teenagers after a serial rapist confessed to the crime. By this time, the five defendants, now adults, had already served sentences of 7 and 13 years. Now the city of New York is refusing to settle a decade-long federal civil rights suit brought by the defendants.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Well, Heidi, you've been a long time and very effective supporter of trying to get Mumia out of prison. And now the long-awaited movie is come out. And I wanted to ask you about the movie. What's it called and where's it showing and what's it about?
The new movie about Mumia is called Long Distance Revolutionary, A Journey with Mumia Abu-Jamal. And I think what sets this film apart is that it's actually not about his legal case, Michael. It's really about Mumia, the writer, the person, as the title says, revolutionary. It examines his life from that perspective.
It's just extraordinary. He's been in prison how many? 3 decades on death row most of that time. And he has not only kept himself together, but he's educated himself and he's written how many books, Heidi?
Well, I think he's on his 7th book right now. He's working on one.
Right, imagine writing a book from death row.
Exactly. And that's what the movie covers. It also puts his case, although it doesn't deal with the legal aspects per se, it does put it in the perspective of the police corruption that existed in the city of Philadelphia. You know, Michael, the Department of Justice actually investigated the police department in Philadelphia and found them corrupt around the same time that Mumia was arrested and convicted. And interestingly, several of the officers who were involved in his case were found to be corrupt under that federal investigation. So the movie touches on that, talks about the Black Panthers. It's directed by Stephen Vittoria from California. He wrote, directed, and edited it. And it has a cast of really wonderful characters.
You're like who?
Well, Cornel West, Alice Walker, Angela Davis. Dick Gregory was in it. He had some amazing lines. Amy Goodman, of course. Reuben Hurricane Carter. Peter Coyote. Ruby Dee. It's a wonderful assembly, really, of people who've known about his life.
Really, everything that's best about American culture in the context of what's worse. And you have a brief cameo, I understand.
I have a couple of brief appearances. But really, Angela Davis plays it, and Cornel West are very prominent and do a wonderful job, really, of casting Mumia's body of work in the context of political oppression that continues to this day, not only in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania, but, of course, around the country.
The movie is called Long Distance Revolutionary, A Journey with Mumia Abu-Jamal. It's playing this past weekend, by the time this show is broadcast, at the Cinema Village. Possibly they'll hold it over for you folks around New York City. Check it out, Cinema Village. But if you're too late for this, hopefully it'll come back. But it is playing in a number of theaters around the country and some places where our show is heard. And where are those, Heidi?
Well, first, I should tell listeners that if you're interested in finding out the full list of where it's playing, go to the website mumia-themovie.com. That's mumia-themovie.com. Or I suppose you could just Google Long Distance Revolutionary. But it's going after New York to Hudson, New York, upstate for a few showings, Princeton, New Jersey, then to Seattle, Washington at the end of February, New Orleans at the end of February, L.A., it will open March 1st, and then it's going to Vermont, Pennsylvania in March. And it's really important, Michael, that we pack the house at these screenings so that for marketing purposes and distribution, it's, I think, really important the first showings that people go.
Yeah, absolutely, because then the theater owners will keep it in the theater longer. And we'll be able to report back to Mamiya when you go visit him, as you do, Heidi, regularly, what it was like to sit in a movie theater which is packed, and we tell his story. So, folks, go see Long Distance Revolutionary, A Journey with Mamiya Abu-Jamal.
Michael, we've covered Chris Hedges' NDAA challenge, and I understand there's a court date coming up very soon.
February 6th. Get out your pencils, because Hedges and his co-plaintiffs, Daniel Ellsberg, Noam Chomsky, are urging people to pack the courtroom. That's room 1505 at 40 Foley Square. That's in downtown Manhattan. That's the old federal courthouse. 40 Foley Square, room 1505. And here's what's going on. Hedges and Chomsky and Ellsberg and four others challenged the indefinite detention provision of the new 2013 National Defense and Authorization Act, which allowed for the U.S. military to pick up a U.S. citizen anywhere in the world, including the United States, and hold them indefinitely. So Hedges and the others went to court, and they had a judge who listened to them. And they said to the judge, "Judge, the definition of terrorism here is so wide that if we as public intellectuals or reporters go interview X, Y, or Z, the government could say that we're aiding terrorism. They could pick us up and hold us and never let us go." And the judge agreed, and she issued an injunction, permanent injunction, knocking that provision of the NDAA out. The government immediately appealed to the appellate court, which is going to hear the case this coming Wednesday, February 6th. They got a stay. So it's out, now it's in. And the question is going to stay in. We don't know.
When you say they got a stay, you mean the government got a stay on the judge's decision.
That's
so
right.
It's
yeah.
As
so
you
it's
said,
like it never
in.
Happened. Right. And this is a very conservative court, you'll remember. Bush's cousin, Judge Walker, sits on this court. This is the court that, after Lynn Stewart was sentenced to 28 months, gave her 10 years instead. This court is not on our side, but like Mr. Dooley said, these courts do count the votes because they've got to retain their legitimacy. As much public support as we can muster is absolutely crucial on this one. This is truly the police state coming home. This is what we predicted after 9/11. This is what our radio show has been all about. If the U.S. Army can pick up American citizens in the United States and hold them indefinitely with no habeas corpus under this vague law, then we're in a lot of trouble.
Michael, we actually interviewed one of the attorneys, Carl Mayer, and we're now going to go to a short excerpt from that interview.
This is a clip of Carl Mayer, who is a National Lawyers Guild supporter, has practiced for many decades out in New Jersey. He's the attorney for Chomsky and Ellsberg and Hedges. He's going to be arguing on Wednesday. I'm going to give you the information once more. Listen to this clip and turn out and show your support. February 6th, Wednesday, 10 a.m., 40 Foley Square, room 1505, the Freedom 7. Come out and show your support.
And remember, now, get there early because you have to wait in line and go through a metal detector.
And now we'll turn to the clip of Carl Mayer.
Everyone's civil liberties are endangered. And what Judge Forrest ruled, in essence, was that this law, the NDAA, is so vague that it doesn't pass constitutional review. It is a violation of the First Amendment because the law says, in essence, that anyone who, quote, substantially supports Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or, quote, associated forces can be covered under the NDAA, which permits the U.S. military to pick up anyone and place them in military and detain them in a military prison until, quote, the end of hostilities, which could be forever. And there's no right to a civilian trial by jury. There's no right to an attorney. This is an authoritarian measure that really smacks of the internments of World War II. It's really something that's unprecedented.
Carl, give us an example of how a journalist could be construed to provide substantial support.
And associate forces, those two things are scary.
Right. Could it be just writing an opinion piece that expresses what the government could see as intellectual support or ideological support?
Correct. That's absolutely correct. And this point was made abundantly clear during the trial and before Judge Forrest. In fact, Judge Forrest repeatedly asked the representatives of the government at the time whether they could offer assurances to the plaintiffs, who are all journalists and activists, like Chris Hedges, formerly of the New York Times, like Daniel Ellsberg, like Noam Chomsky. And Judge Forrest repeatedly asked government attorneys whether she could give them assurances that they would not be subject to detention or military trial under this act. Repeatedly, the government declined to do so.
Could this apply to co-hosts of a radio show?
You bet.
I'll bake you a cake.
I would, yes. I would venture to guess that some of your hosts or co-hosts might be on some list somewhere. But yeah, absolutely. And in fact, we went through several rounds of questioning at trial. Chris Hedges, for example, is a correspondent for many years that covered not only Al-Qaeda, but 17 other groups that are on the State Department terrorism list of terrorist organizations. And so he testified at trial that he believed that the NDAA, he had a reasonable fear that the NDAA could put him in jeopardy. The judge found his testimony credible. He indicated he had a fear not just because of his reporting, but because he does opinion pieces all the time on issues relating to the Middle East and to some of these groups. He's interviewed, you know, members of PLO or Hamas. Who is to say that they're not considered, quote, associated forces under the statute? I mean, you know, as attorneys, what's incredible about this law is there is no definitional section. I have not encountered another statute in practice in 25 years that has absolutely no definitional section. It doesn't define what associated forces are. It doesn't define what substantially supported means. You know, Hedges testified at trial. He had been detained a couple of times by the military for leaving the press pool in Iraq. Now, of course, this is before the NDAA. But the NDAA gives all sorts of, you know, he was detained for a short period of time. But now the NDAA allows these detentions, quote, until the end of hostilities. It's completely open-ended. It really is a heinous statute.
Well, without a definition section, doesn't that render it constitutionally vague?
Correct, and that's what Judge Forrest ruled. And that's what we'll be arguing to the Second Circuit shortly. It is right now the appeal was put on an expedited basis, so we lost the stay, but we got an expedited appeal. The briefing is complete, and we're waiting for an oral argument date. We anticipate that date will be sometime in the next month. In the interim, we have put in motions to the Supreme Court asking them to lift the stay. Unfortunately, Judge Ginsburg denied that motion, citing the expedited appeal. We have one before Justice Scalia now. You know, I imagine that we might not prevail on that, but we hope that this appeal will be heard quickly because we think we have the better of the argument, and we think the record below is very solid. One of the things about this case that's astounding is even though the administration has been aggressively pursuing this case to defend the NDAA along with their Republican brethren, and even though they have they put a fast track on the appeal, they didn't put in any witnesses or affidavits at the trial level. No one to explain what these terms like substantially supported or associated forces or anything of that order would mean. So it's just it's completely vague. That's why Judge Forrest ruled in favor of the plaintiffs here. Just add one other point, which I think is relevant to the show that you just had about these recent documents showing that the FBI and other law enforcement considered Occupy Wall Street to be subject to scrutiny as possibly terrorist groups. Several of our plaintiffs in this case are young activists affiliated with Occupy Wall Street. For example, one of the plaintiffs in our case is Kai Wargala, who founded Occupy London. And Occupy London found themselves on a list of terrorist organizations right next to Al-Qaeda that was put out by the City of London. And this shows how this is going on worldwide, but particularly in the United States. You have the targeting of civilian dissent as being a terrorist enterprise. And you have, you know, everything that comes as dissent these days is branded terrorism. It's eco-terrorism. It's terrorism that's financial terrorism. And it's all under the rubric of stifling dissent. But what this NDAA does is it opens up a whole new chapter, which is to allow the military to directly detain these folks.
That was Carl Mayer, one of the attorneys in the NDAA case. As our listeners know, the Center for Constitutional Rights and the National Lawyers Guild have done a lot of work over the years defending individuals who have been targeted, especially on law school campuses, for being outspoken on behalf of Palestinian rights. It's a national trend that we've seen. So we're very happy to announce a joint collaboration.
Yeah, I think it's really important, Heidi, as we've followed on this program a lot from California to New York. Whenever people talk about or criticize Israel, they're accused of anti-Semitism, they're harassed at universities, they're thrown out of school. There's a huge onslaught against people who dissent on Israel or criticize Israel in any way. And so over the last couple of years, we've tried to have an initiative that would actually give people resources and a right to get seek protection from some combination of the Center for Constitutional Rights and the National Lawyers Guild. And I'm really happy to announce that we finally have a website, and I encourage every listener to go to that website, even if at this point you don't have an issue about your dissent, because it tells you a lot about what your rights are on campus. It'll give you a listing of people who have been harassed, and it'll talk a lot about this issue. The website can be going on to in two ways. You can go directly, PalestineLegalSupport.org. That's PalestineLegalSupport.org. Or you can go to the Center for Constitutional Rights website, and you will be led to the website for giving support to Palestinian dissent in this country. I always used to make a joke that there's an exception to the First Amendment in this country for people who criticize Israel. So we're trying to right that balance a little bit with this website, with legal resources, and willing to help out and get lawyers and advice all across the country. So it's a really important initiative. Once more, the website is PalestineLegalSupport.org. PalestineLegalSupport.org, or you can go through it by going to the Center for Constitutional Rights website. Again, it's a joint operation of the National Lawyers Guild and the Center for Constitutional
Rights.
Just
an extraordinary thing that you, Michael, and you, Heidi, have done on this. I just was so moved when I was on vacation and I read it on my BlackBerry, and I was so moved to see that you finally had put it into place. It's just a great development. And you know, the tide is turning. It used to be that if you were a professor and you said something, you'd lose your job, or if you were a student and you tried to organize something, you were in a lot of trouble. Look at all the Muslim students in California that got censored. In Brooklyn, just this week, the head of the school, Judith Butler, stood up to the pressure from Alan Dershowitz and others. There was a huge, ugly editorial in Daily News. Omar Barghouti and others supporting boycott, divest, and sanction movement were invited by the political science department at Brooklyn College and other student organizations to have a program on Palestinian rights and nonviolent resistance to illegal Israeli actions. And they tried to censor the program, and that president of the university, Judith Butler, she should be encouraged and applauded for what she did. She wrote them back and she said, we've got free speech on this campus and this program is going to go forward. And the organization that the Guild and the Center set up is going to support that in legal ways. So congratulations.
Yeah, I think it's a really great initiative. Again, I encourage everybody to go to that website, spread the word, send it to all your friends. We want everybody knowing about it. We want the Guild and Center lines really lit up.
Repeat the website, Michael.
PalestineLegalSupport.org. PalestineLegalSupport.org. If you get stuck, go to the Center for Constitutional Rights website, and you'll be led to it.
Michael, there's been some recent developments in Guantanamo, something that you follow almost hourly. Bring us up to date.
It's like putting on an old record, not just the 78, but those kind that used to come in tubes that Edison developed.
Wow.
You know, I mean, that's how long. This is 11 years now. We're not making a lot of progress. In fact, I would say we're going backwards. When I say we, I mean Obama and the rest of the administration. So the first event that happened, which was just picked up in a very small way, for a number of years, my office and others have been working with someone named Ambassador Freed. Ambassador Freed is part of the State Department, and he was in charge of closing Guantanamo. He was appointed by President Obama when he took office because Obama promised to close Guantanamo in a year. He appoints a special high-level ambassador. That guy sits at the State Department. And guess what's happened now under the new administration? Well, of course, everybody knows that there's 186 people left at Guantanamo. But now what have they done with Ambassador Freed and the special office to close Guantanamo? I guess the word is abolished it. The office is gone. There's no longer an office at the State Department to actually close Guantanamo. And what they said in the press release is we are transferring his responsibilities to the Office of the Legal Advisor. In other words, they're throwing it. It's like throwing a 52 pickup, like throwing the cards up in the air. And wherever they come down, that's where they come down. No office anymore to close Guantanamo. Not a good sign. Two other things happen at Guantanamo that just prove that the Center for Constitutional Rights position early on, 11 years ago, around military commissions and the, quote, special trials they're having at Guantanamo was correct all along. What we said was you can't have military commissions. Military commissions are not regularly constituted tribunals. They're not tribunals that were in effect at the time of the crimes. They were set up specially after the alleged crimes, and therefore they can be tailored to what the government wants. And we've objected to that from the beginning. There were all kinds of liberals out there saying, well, we can make them better, we can improve this, we can bar evidence from torture, we can do this. But in fact, let's look at what's happened. There's only been two successful trials at Guantanamo. And those two trials, including some guilty pleas, have recently come under fire again because now the circuit court has said that the charge of conspiracy, the conspiracy to kill people or commit, you know, Al-Qaeda or whatever, is an illegal charge under the military commissions, that there's no such thing in military law as conspiracy, and they just tossed out the conviction of the guy who allegedly was bin Laden's driver. Gone. So now what's the government doing? The government is arguing with the prosecutor at Guantanamo. The prosecutor at Guantanamo, who is now in charge of trying the so-called Big Five, the five guys allegedly who were in the conspiracy to attack the World Trade Center, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others, they're charged with conspiracy. The prosecutor says, I don't want to charge him with conspiracy. We charge him with conspiracy. We're going to go to the circuit again and be tossed out. The Obama administration, in all its great wisdom, is saying, we still want to charge him with conspiracy. But the bottom line here, to make this simple, it's 11 years now. We're still sitting there with these five guys and a dozen others who they want to try. They will probably never be tried successfully because the whole thing was a botched, ridiculous effort at speedy justice from the beginning. And instead of speedy justice and really one-sided justice, what you've gotten is no justice at all.
Well, it illustrates that famous quote from the French politician 100 years ago, Georges Clemenceau, who said, military justice is to justice as military music is to music.
Right, but this isn't even court-martial. This is, you go along the spectrum. You got court-martials on, let's say, the most egregious side, and then you got all the way to civil trials, considering they have more protections. And then you have military commissions, which make court-martials look like they're perfect.
Yeah.
Military commissions are just like, they're all in Guantanamo. No one can hardly go there and cover them. In fact, that's the last part of the story. Last week, a number of journalists are there, and they're behind a plate glass, and they can't hear anything unless it's piped in. And there's a red button next to somebody, stands with a red button next to the judge. And if there's secure information that's coming in or classified, he hits the red button. The feed is cut off to the people sitting, the journalists. And it also was on a 40-second delay. So last week, they hit the red button, and they get cut off for whatever, a couple of minutes. And then the judge says, why did you cut that off? There was nothing classified coming in. Apparently, the red button guy heard the word secret, and they were arguing about whether something should be secret or not, nothing to do with classification. He hits the red button. The journalists know nothing about what's going on. And the judge says, what's going on in my courtroom? I have no idea. So this whole thing is just a complete, despicable farce and charade. It's so disgusting to me that early on this was allowed to go through and sadly had support from a lot of people it shouldn't have.
Michael, every year we look forward to your report back from the Sundance Film Festival. Did you see anything great this year?
This will be an incomplete report, and perhaps we'll cover more of it next week. I think the best film I saw in terms of cameos was the 99% film, because not only was it quite good, but our own Heidi Boghossian was a star. She was not just a cameo. She was a star. Because frequently they showed the people in Zuccotti Square and other places across the country being busted, cops doing all kinds of surveillance, going across the country and wiping out the Occupy movement. And there was Heidi, not once, not twice, but probably half a dozen times, talking about what it means to live in a surveillance state, the techniques of the cops. Heidi Bogosian, National Lawyers Guild. And so I just sat there, really. Heidi, you were just great. The film was really good for me in the sense that it brought back all the memories of Zuccotti, but it was also just very good because it tried to give flesh to it about what was happening, for example, in foreclosures and student loans. Heidi was really good on the surveillance. And I'll just give you one fact about the student loans, which is really fascinating. They had a guy from NYU, I don't know if you know him, Heidi or Michael, named Ross, I think is his last name. He's quite good. He talked about student loans. First, he puts up a graph that compares consumer loans to student loans in terms of total amount. Student loans are actually bigger and greater than all of the consumer debt in the United States.
No.
That means everything that you have on your credit cards all over this country is smaller than the amount of money that students owe to their to all these various banks. Then it also pointed out that banks love this stuff. It's the most lucrative, particularly in default, because then there's all kinds of fees. And secondly, which I presume some of our listeners know, is you can't go bankrupt and get out of student loans.
Not anymore. You used to be able
to. So that's like wearing a albatross around your neck for the rest of your life. And this guy, Ross, from NYU, this professor who was great, he basically did a comparison that was really meaningful to me. He said, this is like being an indentured servant.
Yeah.
We all remember when we were kids in like junior high talking about how people from England, you know, they would borrow money and then they would have to work it off for 7 years in some cotton field or, you know, some factory or something. These were not slaves, but they didn't even ever get to get out. But indentured servants got to work for 7 or 10 years to get out. So he said basically what we've created in this society among students is millions of indentured servants. And that's a completely correct analysis. So the Occupy 99% film, I think it's called 99%, with our own Heidi, and it's worth going just for that, is a very good film on not just what happened, but on why it's happening and the background behind it. So that was quite good. It didn't win any awards, but that Sundance took it is to their credit. Not to their credit, and this is the only other film I'll talk about today, is a film called Manhunt. Well, you can imagine what that's about. It's a documentary. It's about the getting of Osama bin Laden, of course. And in the theater that day, there were three CIA agents.
No.
Oh, absolutely. Two women who were on the team that didn't kill him, but were in the office doing the tracking. And somehow it's their story and how heroically these women were discriminated against. And
is one of them the protagonist in Zero Dark Thirty?
Those are the same people. That's the crowd, including the woman, Jeanette, I think, who got killed up at Coast. Okay? So that's the crowd of women. And, of course, their story is we kept wanting to look for bin Laden. We were told not to, et cetera, et cetera. So part of the story is about that. But that's just the beginning of this film. There's a guy in the film named Martin who is the CIA agent in charge of the operation, going on there and, you know, basically saying all these techniques and torture, these are fine. We have to use these things. This is how we got him. Essentially saying that. I don't have the exact words. You have to check that against there. But one of my friends went up to him. He was at a party afterwards, told him he ought to be in jail, which is correct. That guy ought to be in jail. Now, then the other person who is the talking head in the film, the one that was authoritative, was no less than Jose Rodriguez. Jose Rodriguez.
Talk about what he did.
He was head of the Counterterrorism Center during a period of, you know, this first decade, which basically went after bin Laden and everybody else and the enhanced interrogation techniques, torture, etc. Now, what he did and what he became really famous for was he destroyed the videotapes of the waterboarding of Khalik Sheikh Mohammed and others. And he went on about how the first aid techniques, well, those he doesn't consider torture. And he gave an example. If I grab you by the collar and just throw you, that's not torture. If I slap you, that's not torture. He implied that waterboarding might be. And so he's there saying we couldn't have done this without torture, and he's there supporting drones. And he just went on about that. And that's the way the film was allowed to go on. They did put a FBI agent on who said, I don't agree with this, but they just put him on for a second, Ali Sufan. In a sense, Jose Rodriguez was the guy who was the talking head in this
film.
This is
a CIA propaganda.
It's a propaganda film. That's just what I was going to say.
It was. This was what's amazing. This film was made by HBO. Sheila Nevins, I presume, was the head of HBO. And they obviously had to get not just authority from the CIA, because these agents were all exposed.
They
their
needed
names
cooperation.
Were given.
Oh, my
right. God. Not, they needed the cooperation, and they needed the names of the agents to go public with and to bring them to Sundance. So I'm sitting in this film. I see Jose Rodriguez. One of the things he said was a talking head. He said, well, it says that we waterboarded them 183 times. But that's not true. We used 183 pitchers of water. It wasn't separate waterboarding incidents.
Whoa.
This is this guy. It's not enough to make a dispute about to me. But, of course, you can't argue with it in the sense of saying he destroyed the very evidence that could tell us what happened, the videotapes. Yeah,
right.
And, of course, it never said under his name, destroyed
destroyer
the videotapes.
Of the evidence.
Never said it because it was so. The film was so outrageous and so completely one-sided that it should. It was the worst single film, most propaganda I've ever seen.
And what was the audience receptive?
You know, the audience got the impression these people saved us from Osama bin Laden and saved us from more terror. And so they clapped and cheered. And when the CIA guys went on stage, they clapped beyond belief. There were some people in the audience who asked a couple of the questions about.
That's really dismaying.
It was really dismaying.
These are educated people.
Right. And it paid four times.
The price of a ticket to
Utah. Played four times?
And Karen, my wife, she stayed. I was too angry to stay. So Karen stayed, and she said something. I forgot what her question was. And the people next to her said, what are you talking about? These people are protecting us.
Shame on HBO.
It was really. Shame on HBO. Shame on Sundance. This film was an outrage. And then it ends. It ends with McChrystal saying, well, how are we going to end this? We have to have a better understanding of, you know, the Arabic world and our culture. I mean, complete pablum. Because complete pablum in the face of the following, and then I'll end on it. Two or three times they cut to Osama bin Laden in his videos, where he says, I hate the United States. You're good to do jihad against the United States or whatever he says. And before they allow Osama or another al-Qaeda guy to give the reasons they are attacking the United States, which we can accept, not accept, think are all BS, before he's allowed to give those reasons, they're cut off. So we never hear the reasons from the terrorists themselves why they went against the United States. We never hear putting the troops in Saudi Arabia. We never hear Israel and Palestine. We never hear any of that.
Well, the other one, Michael, the other thing, the third thing that he said was the sanctions against Iraq, which killed 600,000 children. Those are the three things that bin Laden said. I mean, I don't think you should go blow up buildings doing that, but those reasons were never articulated.
Michael, is this film billed as a documentary? Because if so, that is totally dishonest and irresponsible.
It's absolutely a documentary.
It's a documentary.
Well, it's based on these women, particularly, and Jose Rodriguez, a little bit
that's
of
that's manipulative, manipulating the audience and pure propaganda.
Yeah, so he leaves out any reasons they give. Let's Jose Rodriguez be the spokesperson who should be in jail. If there's anybody who ought to be in jail other than Bush and Cheney and a couple other guys, it's Jose Rodriguez.
But wasn't he under a court order not to destroy
them? Yes. There was a court order that said in which we had demanded to get any of the tapes, and despite that court order, he destroyed the tapes. Obama then claims he did an investigation and they didn't prosecute the guy. But, you know, that's Jose. Yeah.
Is this film going to be released
HBO.
Into the general?
It's outrageous. It's really disgusting. One other thing I was looking at in the beginning, because in the beginning they start with, you know, showing some Osama bin Laden and the jihad stuff in to throw the Russians out of Afghanistan in the early days. And I was waiting for them to say, these guys were then armed by the United States, and what we got was blowback from our arming of jihadists.
Yeah.
And, of course, they never mentioned it. So the film is a piece of junk, a total propaganda. I called it an HBO CIA propaganda film. One thing that's interesting to me about seeing Manhunt and then seeing Zero Dark Thirty and then putting that together with Green Zone and Argo, each of which have CIA people as their heroes, either women or avuncular CIA people. So if, I know for the three of us in this room, the idea that what we're seeing in four major motion pictures now is a rehabilitation of the CIA to make them into the people that are going to protect us from the bad guys and to make them into these saccharine, wonderful people who are protecting us, I found outrageous. So these four films, Manhunt, Zero Dark Thirty, Argo, and Green Zone, and there may be more, but those are the four I come up with right away. There was one really fascinating incident in the film, Manhunt, that also occurs in Zero Dark Thirty, and that's the killing of the key woman CIA agent up in Afghanistan at Khost, K-H-O-S-T, and that's where they killed about 8 or 10 people, the biggest mass killing of CIA agents ever. And what happened is a Jordanian doctor who they trusted came in with an explosive belt, got through security because they said, don't stop him because we want him to trust us. We trust him. He gets to them and blows them all up. Now, when the film Manhunt, what's very interesting about it, because you have to remember, on the one hand, it's justifying waterboarding and torture, justifying it. And it's also really justifying the Iraq War, and you'll see that in the film. And that's where it gets interesting. So they go to the early part of their Jordanian doctor who blew himself up in Coast and killed Jennifer, the CIA agent, in both of the films. And they point out that this doctor was really upset about the Iraq War, really upset. He's a Muslim guy living in Jordan, and he's a doctor. And he starts blogging against the war in Iraq and probably doing very dramatic blogging. And then what happens in Jordan is they raid his house and they take him prisoner and they take his computer away and they turn him. According to the CIA, they turn him. But he's just blogged about Iraq for months, and they've just raided his house and destroyed it. And they turn him. They claim that he's now a double agent. He's now working for the CIA. So then they bring him up to Coast, where he pulls off the bomb and blows up the CIA agents. What people forget, and didn't come out in either film, is that the Iraq War, one of the key links in the Iraq War, was the Bush administration and Colin Powell claiming that there was a link between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. Where did they get that link from? The CIA tortured a guy named al-Libby. Al-Libby said, yes, Saddam Hussein is supporting Al-Qaeda. And that's what Powell cites in his speech at the UN.
That's right.
So here's the very torture they're saying gives us reliable information that we need. Blowing back and blowing up the very CIA agents who are supporting torture.
Yeah, not to mention the destruction of the entire country of Iraq.
Remarkable.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
April 19th, 1989, a group of five black and Latino teenagers were arrested and convicted for the brutal rape of a white female jogger in Central Park in New York City. It was one of the highest-profile criminal cases at the time. Confessions were coerced from the five children. A New York court overturned the convictions of the five teenagers after a serial rapist confessed to the crime. But by this time, the five defendants, now adults, had already served sentences of 7 and 13 years. Now the city of New York is refusing to settle a decade-long federal civil rights suit brought by the defendants. We're joined today by one of the defendants' attorneys, civil rights lawyer Roger Wareham, to talk more about the case and the Ken Burns and Sarah Burns documentary movie called The Central Park Five.
Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, Roger, over the years, you've taken some significant civil rights cases, and the case that you have now in representing the Central Park Five for what happened to them is really quite extraordinary. Can you tell us the essence of your lawsuit? Who are you representing, for what reasons, and who are the defendants?
Okay. I'm part of a team of lawyers who, between the, it's like one, two, three, four, five firms are representing the five defendants. The defendants in particular that I represent, along with Michael Warren and Evelyn Warren and John Moore, are Kevin Richardson, Raymond Santana, and Antron McCray. The other two plaintiffs are Youssef Salam and Corey Wise, who were represented by Beldock, Levine, and Hoffman, and Corey's represented by Fisher, Berylstein, and Kreiser. The lawsuit arises from the events of April 19, 1989, where a young white female jogger was brutally raped and beaten in New York City and almost died. She lost 75% of the blood in her body that night. The police arrested at some point they'd arrested around 30 youth who allegedly had been in the park earlier that night. Some of them were charged with attacking people who were jogging around the park and things like that. But most of them had been released. These five were in custody, or three were in custody awaiting their parents. Maybe 4 or 5 hours after they were arrested, the Central Park Police Precinct received word that of this woman who was near death. And so they held these five children, because they were 14, 15, and one of them was 16 at the time, held them for questioning, which basically became an interrogation, which basically became a coerced false confession, where each one of them implicated the other ones in the attack on and the rape of this woman, and in doing so implicated themselves. They were under the impression that even though none of them knew each other or knew what actually had happened because they didn't do it, that they would be allowed to go home. They just wanted to go home. They were kept separated from their parents, even though they were all, with the exception of one, under the age of 16, and therefore should not have been questioned without their parents. And by the time their parents were allowed to become part of the process, the false statements, false confessions had already been elicited. For those who were not in New York at that time, and maybe if you were in the country, in the U.S., you would know, because it was really became an international issue in terms of the Central Park jogger rape. It was like the Scottsboro Boys in the 30s. It was a reflection of the racism in New York City and around the country, particularly whenever a black man is accused of touching, assaulting, raping a white woman. Logic, justice, objectivity, evidence goes out the window, and there's a presumption of guilt, and that's what happened with them. They went to trial, they were convicted, even though there was no forensic evidence. And let me cannot overemphasize the fact we have a savvy audience now who understands the importance of forensic evidence. But as I said, this woman had lost 75% of her blood. She was found in a muddy ravine, and yet these five children had nothing that attached them, that connected them to her. There was no blood on their clothing. There was no mud. The DNA didn't match. There was nothing that connected them to the attack on the jogger, except for these statements that don't hold water. And when you look at them now and you put them up together in the film The Central Park Five by Sarah and Ken Burns and David McMahon, do a very good juxtaposition of these statements. They don't make any sense. They don't coincide. The timeline doesn't work. There was nothing to convict them except the racism in New York City and the real relentless diligence and single-mindedness of the New York City Police Department and the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. They were convicted and spent their rest of their teenage lives in jail, and they finished up in adult facilities. Once they were released, they were on probation. They had to register as sexual offenders, as sexual predators, and that's what they were known as. 13 years after their conviction, the person who actually committed the crime came forward and admitted that he had done it. He was a man named Matias Reyes, who had been arrested some 4 months after the jogger incident, the jogger rape on April 19th. He was arrested after a failed attempt at a rape. He admitted, once he was arrested, and was interrogated by a detective named Michael Sheehan, who in New York City is a well-known television reporter, but he was a homicide detective. He was interrogated by him and admitted to not just the attempted rape that he was, arrested on, but 4 other rapes, one of which was of a young woman who was pregnant, who he raped her and murdered her in front of her children.
Yeah.
At that point, they had his DNA on file. As I said, when the DNA came back, nothing matched any of these five children. They were convicted nevertheless. And for some inexplicable reason, when the DNA came back, no one thought to test Matias Reyes's DNA against the missing one in the Central Park jogger, although he was known as the East Side Rapist. So when he came forward and told his story, everything made sense, because he said he worked by himself. He didn't know these kids. His MO was always solo. He described what he had done with the jogger, the way he had tied her hands, that there was a particular way he did that. There was an MO that he employed with the rapes that he had conducted. And so at that point, Ilombe Brath, who was the head of the Patrice Lumumba Coalition, a founding member of the December 12th movement, and lived in that complex, used to live in that complex where...
Yeah, up in Harlem, where they all
in
lived.
Harlem, where, yeah. where three of them came from, the Schomburg Plaza, asked Michael Warren and myself and Evelyn Warren to, be involved with a motion to overturn their convictions. And so we became involved on the legal level, although on the political level, I'm part of an organization called the December 12th Movement that had always supported these children from the time of their arrest in 1989. We, along with some other lawyers, had their convictions overturned. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office had done a very thorough reinvestigation, and this was the same office that had prosecuted them. And they put forward a really damning affirmation in support of our motion, basically admitting that they had prosecuted the wrong people, that errors had been made, that it was clear that the one and only perpetrator was Matias Reyes, and they were not going to retry the case on any of the charges, which included some of the assaults in the park. They just said that everything was dirty and that it was clear that they hadn't done it.
Well, Roger, let me ask you this. Given this turnabout by the city of New York, why hasn't the city settled the civil cases that you've brought for these five now adults and try to compensate them to the extent that money can compensate, try to compensate them for the terrible wrong that they did to them? Why hasn't this case settled?
That is the... Well, it used to be the $64,000 question, but that isn't a lot of money anymore.
Not that much anymore.
Telling my age. Their convictions were overturned 10 years ago, December 2002. The civil suit was filed in December 2003, so we're going on 9 years. A week before last, the city controller, John Liu, held a press conference where he said he would put his offices forward to settle this 24-7, both sides sit down. City Council Member Barron and State Senator Perkins were there, and they pointed out to the comptroller that the plaintiffs have always been willing to sit down and settle this case. The city, to this point in time, has not even made an offer. It isn't like they made an offer that was refused. They haven't made an offer. Our view is, the other part that I got left out was that after the convictions were overturned, the police department, which had been conducting its own investigation, issued a report called the Armstrong Report, whose conclusion was that the confessions were valid, that the five of them had been involved in it in some way or other, notwithstanding the lack of any evidence, and that the police department had not done anything wrong. Because the question becomes, if they were never at the scene, that they were never involved with it, where did these so-called statements come from? And how, that they had to have come from the police, since the five of them, I think maybe only Corey and Youssef knew each other. But the five of them made statements talking about what each of the other ones had done, which were a complete fabrication. And since they weren't in the same room talking with each other, where did it come from? It could have only come from one source. And so the police department has closed ranks. Our view is that that's what lies behind the fact that they haven't even made an offer to settle this. And for the New York audience, on December 24th, the New York Daily News had an editorial entitled Justice Endlessly Delayed, which basically calls on the case to be settled. And and the New York Daily News was one of the media vehicles who led the charge that these children should have been convicted and lynched back in 1989. And so that is, I think, a reflection of the same question you asked me, why hasn't it been settled? Well, if you want to look to why hasn't it been settled, you look to Police Commissioner Kelly, who endorsed the report, and he's a defendant in this suit, because even though he wasn't the police commissioner at the time, we're charging him with intentional infliction of emotional distress by endorsing this report and saying that they're still guilty. My view is that, as litigating attorneys, you know that usually sometimes they'll wait till they get to the just before the jury's picked and settled, but the amount of pain that this has continued to cause these children, and they're almost 40 now. They're grown men, and their family is just unbelievable. And when we're out in the streets talking to people about the case, everyone in the city has assumed that this was a no-brainer, and this case would have already been settled. So that's where we are.
Roger, this is Michael Ratner speaking. I followed the case, obviously, since the very beginning as a New Yorker, and I saw Ken Burns and Sarah Burns' film, The Central Park Five, and of course it's completely shocking. I mean, it's so painful to watch innocent people railroaded to jail and watch their parents in tears and crying and their lives destroyed, and that to see that the case hasn't been settled. But what I read, and is even worse, it seems to me, is the city has actually subpoenaed the outtakes from the film, the interviews that Ken and Sarah Burns did with the plaintiffs in your lawsuit about what they said. So it's not just that they're refusing to settle. Of course it is that. But they're even being incredibly outrageously aggressive. It's not enough they falsely convict them and then destroyed lives and had parents have to cry as their kids were carted off to prison for something they didn't do. But now they're continuing it, the emotional destruction every day. I don't know.
It's not a passive defense. You're right. It's a real active defense around, we're going to win this. You know, we're going to beat you down into the ground. And so, but I think the subpoenaing of the outtakes is also a reflection of their desperation. Because they know. See, they know the truth. They know what they did. They know what the truth is. So they're floundering around looking for different straws to grab at. Hopefully, I assume they think in one of the outtakes, one of the guys is going to say, you know, this is really BS. Yeah, we did it. We got over. And that's
yeah, right.
That could be the only thing that they'd be looking for. Because there's nothing else.
Yeah. It is so sad to me and so outrageous. I mean, because, you know, we all remember you do when, you know, full-page articles asking for the death penalty.
Donald Trump. Donald Trump did.
And here we have
what Mayor Ed Koch did.
And Koch was, we got him. This is, you know, and Donald Trump took out, there were five dailies in New York back in 1989. He took out a full-page ad in all of them calling for the return of the death penalty. And that was part of the motion that led to the return of the death penalty. The factor that hasn't asserted itself enough, I believe. I mean, you know, we work inside the legal realm, but we also have a political consciousness and know that there's not been sufficient motion in the streets in terms of people just expressing their concern. When we back in 2002, when we brought the motion to overturn the convictions, the 440 motion, you know, every time we were in court, the courtroom was full. When we left the court, it'd be press conferences, it'd be demonstrations. But that was also something that just created an atmosphere around justice needs to be done, justice needs to be done quickly. Recently, in the last few court appearances, we've had status conferences. The courtroom has been filled, so much so that the last court date that we had on January 17th, the judge had accepted, you know, the previous court date, we'd asked the judge to move it to another courtroom because people couldn't get in, and the courtroom was too small, so we granted the application. So it was being held. It was held in a much larger courtroom. So I think, you know, the question of the film, because I think the film has brought it back to the larger consciousness of people. The fact that the city subpoenaed the outtakes and that garnered further publicity. So the people are like, this is, as you said, it's outrageous. It needs to be resolved. I think John Liu, the controller, if he's running for mayor, or if not, he's at least made it an issue that anyone who is considering elected office has got to deal with. And hopefully all of those factors, along with the simple fact that this needs to be settled, will move towards a rapid resolution of this.
Well, Attorney Roger Wareham, you do great civil rights work. We're so pleased and honored to have you on Law and Disorder. We wish you every success. Is there a website or something that we can tell our listeners to plug into so they can find out when the next court appearances are going to be?
No, but what I can give them is a number to call, and then we can get back to them. The website is still being dealt with. They can call 718-398-1766.
Repeat that.
718-398-1766. That's the phone number for the December 12th movement, and you'll be able to get your information and get back to you in terms of what are the different things that are happening.
Well, Roger, Michael, and I, and Heidi in absentia, wish you all the luck on this.
Thank you for this long struggle. I mean, this has been a long one, Roger, so thank you
very
much. Well,
you know how those go. You all have been involved long for
years. Good work, and we're looking forward to having you on again to announce a victory.
Oh, yeah. Okay, definitely.
Take it easy, Roger.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Scared us 20 odd years.